I'm Dr. Ken Huey of CALO, a residential treatment center for adopted children from the ages of 9 to 18. Our kids struggle with emotional and behavioral issues, and they have a trauma background. Today, we're here to talk with Joe Restuccia. Another interview from the Educating Traumatized Children Summit, an online gathering of expert voices in how to provide trauma-sensitive school experiences to children. This summit has been created by the Attachment and Trauma Network. As I said, we're here with Joe Restuccia, and we're going to talk about the impact of trauma and the importance of trauma-sensitive schools on a child's ability to learn. Joe Restuccia is a certified school psychologist with over 25 years' experience working in the public schools. Over the last 20 years, he has worked with students at risk for failure due to social, emotional, and behavioral difficulties. Mr. Restuccia has served as a consultant on the impact of trauma on student learning to the Trauma and Learning Policy Initiative, TLPI, and is a co-author of Helping Traumatized Children Learn. Additionally, he has consulted to the Department of School Psychiatry, Massachusetts General Hospital, presented program model research findings at the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, AACAP, presented for the Departments of Education in Massachusetts, Wisconsin, West Virginia, and Washington, as well as the University of Wisconsin on topics related to the impact of trauma on learning and on the role of trauma in student behaviors that can lead to punitive discipline and school failure. Mr. Restuccia is an adjunct professor at Lesley University, teaching courses in developing trauma-sensitive school-wide classroom and individual interventions to support all students to be successful in the general education curriculum. Mr. Restuccia holds an EDM from Harvard University and a BA from Yale. Joe, welcome.
Ken, it's really a delight to be here and happy to be a part of your program. Thank you.
You bet. Well, let's jump right in. How widespread is the problem of early childhood trauma?
Well, I think prevalence is one of the key issues for people to know and understand to really get to why we spend so much of our resources and time talking about trauma and trauma-sensitive schools. You know, if you look at the adverse childhood experience studies done by Anda and Folletti, I think they gave a very good view as to the prevalence of traumatic experience and that it's much higher than any educators would have thought. That their studies show that 50% of our school-aged children experience physical, emotional, sexual abuse, witness domestic violence, have significant substance abuse and mental illness in their homes, as well as maybe living with folks who in the home who've been to prison and been involved significantly with the law. And if you add to these, you know, they looked at a specific number of categories. If you add to these issues such as neglect, being chronically bullied in school, periods of homelessness, live in a neighborhood where there is a significant amount of community violence, refugees from areas of war, medical issues, acrimonious divorce. I mean, you think of all the other areas, experiences that students have, you begin to understand that traumatic experience is a significant part of a lot of our students' lives, and it's much more than, you know, just the majority of students that have been affected by significant adversity. And I think it's also important when we talk about prevalence to understand what we mean by trauma and traumatic experience. And, you know, experts explain that trauma is not the event itself. It's not an event, but it's rather how we respond to that event. And that it's a response that is characterized by feeling overwhelmed and our ability to cope is dramatically undermined. And that these experiences in childhood can lead to a cascade of social, emotional, and cognitive difficulties, which not only can impact school success, but can lead to the adoption of high-risk behaviors such as substance abuse, sexual promiscuity, cutting, eating disorders, and other related pieces.
Yeah. So. All right. So quite a wide range of issues coming into that. What kind of
yes.
implications does this early childhood trauma have for school systems?
I think for the impact on school systems and student learning can be quite significant, and I think I'd want to start by talking a little bit about just an overview of some of the neurobiological, epigenetic, and psychological impacts of these experiences on kids, because I think it's important to understand that students impacted by traumatic experience act, behave, and learn the way they do because of the very real impacts this has on who they are and how they've developed. Neurobiologically, if you look at some of the impacts that these experiences can have, students with significant traumatic experience could be impacted first in the size of different brain systems that they have, systems that can impact language, memory, particularly sequential memory. In addition to that, it also can impact how they use different parts of the brain. If you think about students in school, we want them to be thoughtful. We want them to be analytically and critically thinking about the material they're reading, the material we're discussing. So we want them to be in that thoughtful part of their brain, in that sort of neocortex, that upper part of the brain. A lot of the trauma response of the limbic system lives in a very primitive part of the brain that is the more reactive part of the brain. So oftentimes students with significant traumatic experience come to school and they're not operating in the thoughtful part of their brain, they're really operating in the reactive part. So they might present in class as being overreactive, responding inappropriately to very mild or moderate stress indicators, and so that it's difficult for them to settle and really engage in that critical thinking and learning that we'd like them to have. I think the last piece I'd want to mention is that students with significant traumatic experience often are on a daily roller coaster of stress hormone injection into their bloodstream and absorption out. So they're on this roller coaster of very high levels of stress hormones and very low levels of stress hormones, which can certainly impact their ability to focus as well as the behavior and presentation. So there are these sort of core neurobiological, or if you will, physiological impacts that traumatic experience can have on kids. And again, this is just an overview. There's a lot more research and a lot more detail on some of it. But I want to get to, so what does that look like in school? How does that affect the student in school? And I want to begin really looking at I want to talk about the academic impacts, the behavioral impacts, and then the impact on the student's ability to relate and connect. And academically, I want to talk about academics in two ways. The first is what I call core skills or core academic skills. Oftentimes, and again, as I talk through these, I want to be clear, not every student with significant traumatic experience is going to demonstrate all of these, but I think you'll see, certainly educators will see, that it only takes one or two to put the student at significant risk for school failure. And so when we look at core academic skills, the first thing I would look at would be language. Verbal, expressive, written, reading, and as well as nonverbal language and interpretation of nonverbal cues. In addition to that, can have a significant impact on memory, particularly sequential memory, that ability to order and organize information. In addition to some of those basic fundamental academic skills, it can also impact academic learning or if you will, learning process. And here I talk first about executive function. Executive function being that process, that goal-directed process that underlies everything we do, not just in academics, but in all parts of our life, social and otherwise. And it's that process of setting a goal, developing a plan to achieve that goal, executing the plan, and then reviewing that plan to see, or our actions, to see if we achieved what we wanted to, and if we did, to store that away. And if we didn't, maybe to make some adaptations to the plan so the next time we're presented with the plan, you know, we have a more effective approach. And, of course, what I just described was a process that involves explicit thinking and the development of a learned and remembered sequence or chronology. And students who struggle with memory, particularly sequential memory, are going to have a very difficult time with executive function. So oftentimes those executive function pieces are or skills are just not well developed and need to be explicitly taught. The second piece is transitions. Kids with significant traumatic experience can have some difficulty with transitions. If you think of a student coming into a classroom and they sit in that classroom, oftentimes in the midst of all that noise and whatnot, they're scanning for potential danger. So they'll spend a lot of their energy and time, you know, hearing what's going on in the hallway. How close is the teacher coming? What's the tone of voice? Who's approaching me? Is there someone behind me? And so as they're scanning, really scanning to make sure that they're going to be okay and that there aren't any threats in the room, the class is settling, papers might be handed out, and at some point as things quiet, the student stops the scanning process and looks and things are quieting down because people are in class and now they're doing an assignment that's been handed out. And so the student looks down and there's a paper in front of them. And it would be great in this situation, I think, if the student could raise their hand and say, "Excuse me, I've been somewhat hypervigilant here in this classroom, just making sure that I'm going to be okay. And I really don't know what this assignment is about, so if you could redo the instructions, I'd like to get to it." But of course, students don't do that. Right? In the best of circumstance, what you get is a student that's learned some splinter skills to get through the class. Name, date, I'm sure there's a date written somewhere. Is there a word bank I'm drawing from? I wonder what my neighbor is doing, but then I'll probably get told, "Don't worry, you can do it yourself, don't copy your neighbor." But they develop these skills to get through the class. And so they're not really developing that framework for academic and cognitive skill development. They're learning how to get through so that they can make it to the next one. And that's in the best case. In some cases, you might get pushback. You might get a student that says, "I'm not doing any work today." You might get a student who rips the paper in half or throws it on the floor. You might get that kind of pushback as students try to control that situation. So that transition...
So talk about
piece,
that for a second. So ripping the paper in half, what do you think is going on then? You're painting a picture of specific behaviors we might see. Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
If you can tie those together, the sort of executive functioning, sequential memory, and the behaviors that we're seeing, what that picture might look like, that's really helpful.
Yeah, I think that oftentimes the pushback we see from students, particularly in those academic, in that situation I just described, many times for me, that's the student trying to exert some control in that situation to minimize their sense of unease or dis-ease in that situation. And so better to push back and say, "I'm not doing it," than to have the paper not having heard the instructions and not being able to execute the task in a successful manner.
Sure.
So there's that piece. And then the last piece to me is attention. You know, oftentimes a lot of students will carry, particularly with traumatic experience, will carry an ADHD diagnosis. But if you think of what I just described of that student coming into the classroom, it's not that he's not paying attention or she's not paying attention. It's that they're paying attention to all the wrong things. They're paying attention to tone of voice, to things they may perceive as a potential threat. And so... You know, I mean, I worked with a student in the fourth grade, and as I was walking down the hall one day, his teacher popped her head out of the room and said, "Would you mind spending some time with Johnny? Because he doesn't seem to be here today." And we went for a walk and found some space and sat, and I said, "So what's up?" And he said, "Do you hear that sound?" Now, he is hearing this sound that I stop and listen, and I can't hear it. I say, "Tell me what it sounds like." And he said, "It's sort of a rumble," and I listen again, and I hear this sound, a very faint sound of far-off heavy equipment. And I say, "You mean that sound?" He goes, "Yeah." He said, "Do you think they're going to dig a hole and hit the gas pipe and it's going to blow up the school like what happened on Elm Street last week?" Well, the previous week in town, they'd been digging in the street. They had a gas pipe, leaked gas into the neighboring house, and it blew the house up. Now, there was no one in the house, so there were no injuries, but the student heard that and remembered that, comes to school, is hearing this very faint noise, and is immediately thinking, "Oh my gosh, are they going to dig and hit a pipe? Are they going to dig and hit a pipe?" And we were able to, you know, go out, visit the driver. He asked the driver the question. The driver said, "I'm spreading, I'm not digging." He relaxed, came back into school. But I think it's illustrative of, you know, the students paying attention to things that sometimes we're not aware of. You know, we're constantly filtering that extraneous stuff out that they might be focused on, we're not aware of. We don't know where this disconnection is coming from, but in fact, when you can get with the student and talk to them, you begin to understand that for them this is very real, whether it's in fact real or perceived as real by them. The point is that they're focused there, and it's impacting their ability to focus.
Absolutely.
And so that's, you know, so in the learning process, it's executive function, it's transitions, and it's attention, and again, paying attention to the relevant information in school and in class as opposed to irrelevant to the learning process information, but very relevant to the student. So that's sort of the academic piece. But then there's a behavioral piece that students bring in. And probably the most obvious to educators is that student who is very reactive, very impulsive. That student I described in transitioning into the classroom and might actually tear a paper in half or push it off the desk or say that I'm not doing a paper or a test today. That sort of impulsive, not thoughtful sort of reaction back. You can get that and see that in the students. That involves also some emotional lability. They may switch emotion from very happy to very sad in a very quick fashion. The second most noticeable behavior is that pushback behavior, that not today, thanks anyway. They may use more colorful language than that, but I think you know what I'm talking about. They're exerting a little bit of resistance, a little bit of pushback to try and gain some control, as we talked about a few minutes ago. But there is a third group, and to be honest, those two groups, I like those two groups. In fact, I enjoy working with them, but I really appreciate the fact that it's as if they're raising their hand saying, I'm having a problem. Hey, over here.
I see.
Everything is not good.
The signs are so obvious.
Yeah, I mean, they've put it right out there. But that third group is a harder group because they've learned to fly under the radar.
Uh-huh.
Don't make any waves. Don't say anything. Take it all inside. Keep it quiet, and I'm going to be okay. And so for them, I worked with a young man. One of the first jobs I had as a psychologist in schools, I was in the guidance office, and the guidance secretary took it upon herself to introduce me around to regular kids. And one of these kids I met, we got along quite well, and we would talk sports and just stuff. And he'd drop by the office every morning before school, and we'd chat for a few minutes, and then he'd go off to class. And I worked, he did that with me. I wasn't working with him. He was just visiting me for a couple of years. He graduated, never thought anything about it. This was an average kid in the school. 12 years after he graduated, I got a letter from him thanking me for being there, that in fact his dad had been physically abusing him. School was his safe place, and I was the transition back to school from home.
Amazing.
I was his chance to sort of breathe and say, I'm going to be okay. And it was none of us had any idea that this was going on with this kid. No one in town, in school, no one had any clue about what was actually going on. And so these kids are there. You've got the kids who are right up front with it, either in their impulsive, reactive behavior, in their aggressive, pushback behavior, but you've also got kids flying under the radar. And before I leave the behavior thing, I want to make two points. One is that a lot of this behavior we see in kids is their attempt to try and keep themselves safe, right? Controlling situations, reacting, staying under the radar. And the other piece is that not every student that presents, as I've just described, is necessarily a student with a significant traumatic experience background. I want to be clear about that differentiation. So the last piece I want to talk about is student relationships in school. And, the behaviors that I've talked about in terms of the executive function, transitions, that labile mood shift, that sort of aggressive demeanor, or even that flying under the radar, these behaviors, these characteristics of how they learn are also part of their interaction patterns with others. And if you think about someone who you are working to be a friend with or working to relate to, and they are not understanding how you're feeling, they're not responding, they're rapid unexpected mood shifts, maybe they've got some language issues and they can't really tell a joke or they can't tell a story, It's very difficult for these students to really create the kind of friendships and relationships that other people might have. And that's with peers
sure.
as well as with adults. So oftentimes their relationships are can be significantly impacted. So
yeah, even in that situation, in the social situation, they're not paying attention to the most important social cues because they're so hypervigilant and missing the boat.
Yes,
then.
Exactly. Huh. Exactly.
Okay, so you know, we've got all this impact all
yep.
over in the student learning arena.
Yep.
How do trauma-sensitive schools address these needs?
Yeah, and that's a that's really to me to us at TLPI and to me sort of a key piece. And I think you start with there's really two elements to how trauma-sensitive schools address the needs of kids and help them to be successful. The first is how we think about students. That we need to think about students as the whole child. That students are more than just academic achievement machines. That we need to think of students in terms of their competencies, both academic and otherwise. We need to think about students in terms of their ability to regulate their emotions as well as their behavior. Students in terms of their relationships with adults, peers, both inside of school and outside of school, and also physical health and well-being of the students. And we came to this concept of whole child initially in the project by really looking at, so what do developmental and trauma psychologists say about the key components that underlie the health of students, children and students? And they talked in different words, Ken, but they talked about the same concepts, attachment or relationships. They talked about regulation. They talked about competency or, you know, strengths and those types of issues. And that we used that in some of our initial work and also began to realize that the physical health and well-being of the child was also an important piece. And so we think of this, we refer to these as our four domains for students. I think a better way to think of it or a more common way to think about it is to think in terms of the whole child. So we start by the needs of the whole child. Trauma-sensitive schools are schools that address the needs of the whole child and really are characterized by the following attributes, if you will, that there is a shared understanding in the school among all staff, and all staff includes not only professional staff, but not professional staff as well, that everyone in that school understands the potential impact of traumatic experience on students, so that they're aware. You know, they don't have to be experts, but they need to be aware of what that is. And that schools, one of the most important things they can do is to support all children to feel safe physically, socially, emotionally, and academically. That children's traumatic responses and the associated difficulties are often rooted in real or perceived threats, you know, things that we've talked about. And so the first step is to really help them feel safe in the classroom, on the playground, in the hallway, the cafeteria, the bus, the gym, wherever they're going to be in school and in the system of school. And again, safety, not just physical safety, but also social and emotional safety, and in class that academic safety where they feel okay sort of taking that risk, kind of stepping out of their comfort zone and taking the risk. So that safety is one of those, is that second attribute. The third is that, again, we address the needs of the whole child in the school, not just the academic child. A trauma-sensitive school really recognizes the interconnectedness of these components that we call the whole child. You know, I talk about them individually, Ken, but in the child, they're all interwoven and integrated. You know, I worked in a school with a student in an urban city, and there was a student who had some good academic skills, or certainly grade level academic skills, and he wasn't doing any work. And we were working real hard to figure out how to help this student actually do work in school. And the student, it was a grammar school, K-8, and the student really wasn't doing much work. He was not disruptive. He was not interfering with others. I mean, he wasn't doing work, so that in itself could be interfering in a class, but he wasn't actively disruptive. As we thought about the student and tried different things out, we stepped back and said, well, let's take a look at let's take a look at the whole child. And, you know, he was fairly well regulated. He had decent academic competencies and skills. But when you looked at his relationships, Ken, he had none. None in school. Not that he didn't know and kids and teachers, but he didn't hang out with anyone. There were no close relationships. We spoke to his mom and dad, and they said same way at home. He's really not related. Sure. And so what we did in school is he fashioned himself a basketball star. He was too young to play on the 7th and 8th grade team, but the coach said, I'll take him on as a manager. So the coach then took that perceived competency, leveraged it to begin to develop relationship with the student, and then said, so whose class are you in? Oh, I'm in Miss McGillicuddy's class. Oh, she's a friend of mine. Say hello for me. And is there an instructional assistant? Yeah, it's Mr. Bill. Say hi to him. And, you know, and he started to get connected. And, of course, on the team, he's knowing 7th and 8th graders. They're saying hello to him in the hallway. And as he's developing relationship and feeling more connected to community, he starts doing some work. Now, did he do all his work all the time? No, but now he was getting work done, and now we had the beginning of some traction to begin to engage him in work, because he was a bright kid and a competent student. So it is that, again, that whole child, these pieces all relate, and sometimes the key to academics is not necessarily time in learning, and I want to be clear, I'm a fan of time in learning, but sometimes it is one of those other elements of the whole child that is the key to getting us to engage them in the learning process. And I think that that story also emphasizes the next point, which is the importance of connecting kids to the community. How do we draw them into the community? How do we create a culture in the school that is a culture of acceptance and tolerance? Individual student supports and policies that not only support kids, but also support their connection to the school community. So often we do pullouts and that type of thing that tend to isolate kids. How do we set that up in a way that it tends to bring kids more into the community? It's a very important piece, connecting them to the community. The school embraces teamwork in that staff share responsibility for all kids. You know, you can't address the needs of these kids just with classroom teachers. They need to be part of a community, and the community that that shares, that sort of asks the question, if you will, shares responsibility, what can we do as a community to support all children, to help them feel safe, participate fully in our school? That is, you know, that the school embraces these kids as our kids. That trauma-sensitive schools really help staff inside and outside the school to be a strong, supportive professional community that's addressing the needs of the children and solving some of the issues that they present.
There's this term whole school, a whole school approach. That's really what we're talking about then.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Definitely whole school. And, you know, and I guess the exclamation point to whole school is that leadership and staff really can adapt to the ever-changing needs of the student and the community. I mean, if there's one constant in schools, it's change. And so are we aware of the changes that are coming, whether it's a state mandate from the Department of Ed, whether it's a community initiative that's going to shift, or things we want to do in school? What are they going to be? How's it going to affect our students? And how do we work together to really address that, you know, as a community? So community is a in community connection, and then the adaptability and ability to meet the ever-changing needs are key points as well. So those elements, that awareness, that sense of safety, that connection of the students, addressing the whole child, working together as a team, and then being adaptable to the ever-changing environment that schools operated in, that those are really cornerstone attributes of creating a whole school trauma-sensitive school community.
Yeah. One part that you talked about was, you know, creating the safety. If I could just kind of step back to that for a second and ask, really, how? What are some strategies for creating the safety for the social support, for instance, to get a child to be able to feel you talked about this one child that it was really kind of guided through that process. But in general, how do you create safety for a kid?
Yeah, safety is, you know, for students, it's a lot of it is about structure and predictability. That, you know, how do we help students understand what the day is going to look like, what that flow is going to look like, who do they have that they're connected to, that if an issue comes up that they can look to that individual to answer a question, to support them if they're feeling a little upset put off by a change in that schedule, that predictability. But it's about predictability, it's about structure, it's about clear limits and expectations, and knowing where those limits are, and if I test those limits, that there is a not just a punitive response, but there's a restorative response that helps me learn where that limit is, that helps then reconnect me back to the community to recover, if you will, from that, from moving across that boundary and continue to move ahead being part of that community. And I would also say that safety and connection, safety and relationships, if you will, and connection to the community are really intertwined. You know, I talk about them separately, but it's almost like the whole child piece. They really interact in a very intricate way.
Yeah. So. Okay. So one last question for you.
Sure.
If I'm an educator, I'm here listening to this, a teacher, administrator, what should I be doing next to make sure that my school is trauma sensitive?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And, you know, TLPI has done a lot of work to try and answer that question. And I would throw out that there are a couple of things that you can do that really there's no expense involved. And it's really furthering your knowledge and information as well as, you know, beginning to see what this road looks like. How do I get from point A to point B? And the first is, you know, my recommendation would be that you read the Purple Book, Helping Traumatized Children Learn, Volume 1. It really gives a much deeper, better understanding or better explanation, if you will, of the impacts of trauma on kids and their learning. The second thing is that I would suggest that you read Chapter 1 of Helping Traumatized Children Learn, Volume 2, which really is an overview of creating trauma-sensitive schools. So it gives you the key tools and the processes and whatnot that tie into that. These publications, by the way, I want to be clear, they're available for no cost as PDF downloads on our website. I don't want this to sound like I'm selling books. I'm not.
I
am recommending resources that are available. In the website, I could give you that as well. It's www.traumasensitiveschools.org. So it's www.traumasensitiveschools.org. And it's you know, you can download those PDFs for free. It's there, and you know, it's for you to take. I think the last piece would also be to join the coalition. You can do it through the website, and by doing that, it kind of puts you in the loop. It keeps you aware, it keeps you informed, and keeps you as part of this work as we're moving forward. So it's education through the resources, it's being aware of the website and accessing it, and then it is, in fact, joining that coalition and really taking the step to be a part of it. And, of course, we're available to answer questions, to support, to guide in any way that we can to help anyone who's interested in doing it.
Fantastic. Gosh, thank you, Joe Restuccia, so much for joining us today. I really do
appreciate
it. The hypervigilance, it's not that they aren't paying attention, it's not they're paying attention to all the wrong things. The whole child concept, really some great, great stuff. I'm very, very much appreciative. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you.
You bet. Well, this is Dr. Ken Huey of KALO for ATN's Traumatized Children Summit. This is one of over 20 interviews that are a part of this summit. If you would like a complete set of all of the recordings from the summit or a set of recordings with transcripts, you can visit our website to purchase them, and they will be available to download at the end of the summit. You can get more information at www.attachu.org. That's A-T-T-A-C-H-U, just the letter U, .org/events/summit. At ATN, I sit on the board, and we're committed to helping traumatized children and their families. If you'd like to learn more about the support, education, and advocacy we provide, please visit our main website at www.attachtrauma.org. Thank you for tuning in today, and please join us again for our other interviews.